What's so great about being a believer? If someone were to ask you that question, I wonder how you would answer. Perhaps some of you would find it a very easy question to answer. Words would flow from you as you set about doing so. Perhaps others of you, however, would find it much harder to answer the question, what's so great about being a believer? Because perhaps the reality is you've forgotten what's so great about being a believer. You know you are a believer, you've no plans to stop being a believer, but the whole thing has become something of a slog. The Christian life has become something of a grind. And if that is the case, then perhaps Psalm 34 is a good place for you to go this evening. Derek Kidner, in his commentary on the Psalms, describes this as a glowing psalm. It's not a psalm in which the author confesses his sin. It's not a psalm in which the author complains about his very trying circumstances. There are many psalms in both those categories, and we value them and we're glad for them. They're important psalms, but this isn't one of them. This psalm pulsates. This psalm exudes an infectious enthusiasm. This psalm brings us back, I think, to what's so great about being a believer. And so in that regard then, I would like you to notice with me this evening four themes in this psalm. First of all, community. Community. And this is verses 1 to 7. Because in this section of the psalm in particular, in the first 7 verses, David revels in the fact that he is not then a believer in glorious isolation. He's not this lone believer existing entirely in solitude, but rather he's part of a believing community. David revels in that reality. And there are several aspects then of this believing community, participation in the community of believers, several aspects that he loves. First of all, he loves being an encouragement to God's people. He loves being an encouragement to God's people. Verse 2. It's there then the fact that he can make the people of God glad. He can gladden, he can cheer, he can hearten, he can encourage the people of God that so excites him. And how then can David do this? What is it about David that enables him to have an encouraging impact on his fellow believers? Is it that he's been on some 6-week course to learn a whole series of sophisticated techniques for encouraging your believing brothers and sisters? Well, no, it's not that. It's not that David has some very clever secret for encouraging his fellow believers. How does he encourage them? He encourages them by his soul making its boast in the Lord. My soul makes its boast in the Lord. Let the humble, that is my fellow believers, hear and be glad. There's nothing fancy about this. There's nothing complicated about this. But as David mingles with his fellow believers, he drops in little comments into the conversation. Isn't God good? Isn't it great, dear brother, that God is in control of everything, including what's happening in your life and in my life just now? Isn't it breathtaking, dear sister, that God gave up his one and only son for people like us? David couldn't have said that. But these are the kind of comments then that we can take and through which we, I think, can do what David is doing here. We can encourage one another, we can hearten, we can gladden one another just by boasting in the Lord ourselves. As we talk, just in our normal conversation, about how great God is and how wonderful God is and how beautiful God is, then others will find that a means of grace in their own experience and be blessed and be encouraged by it. And David then revels in that. He finds that exciting. He glories in this fact that he can be an encouragement to his brothers and sisters. So he loves being an encouragement to God's people. Secondly, he loves being a worshipper with God's people. Being a worshipper with God's people. Verse 3, "Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together." Imagine that you go and watch a tennis match. It's between Andy Murray and Rafael Nadal. And in this tennis match, then Andy Murray just plays the match of his life, and he absolutely thrashes Nadal. Nadal only wins 2 or 3 points in the whole match. That's how good Murray is. It's an amazing feat of tennis by Andy Murray. But imagine that for some strange reason, as you look around you, you're the only spectator in the whole arena, and every other seat in the place is empty. Well, you could say that's absolutely great. You've got this private experience of watching this amazing match. But in actual fact, it wouldn't be great, would it? Because in that situation, you would want other people, people sitting near you, to be able to turn to and say, "Wow, what a shot that was." People on the train home with you who are at the match that you can, and you can chat through with them that rally at the start of the second set. People on Twitter and on the internet fan forums with whom you can exchange personal highlights from the match afterwards. You would want it to be something of a shared experience. And you see, every Sunday we have the experience not of going and watching a great tennis match, but something far, far better than that. We have the privilege of going and gazing upon God himself. And you see, the wonderful thing is that we have others with whom it can be a shared experience. We can say every Lord's Day morning what David says here in verse 3, "Magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together." David revels in this fact, that not only does he have a great God to meditate on, to gaze on, to stand and view, but he has others with whom to do it. It can be this shared experience. Thirdly, he loves being an enjoyer of God's people. Being an enjoyer of God's people. Verse 5. Those who look to him are radiant, and their faces shall never be ashamed. And I think he's saying here then that he's drawn to God's people. He finds them attractive. He finds them beautiful. He finds them radiant. And I think he's talking at a physical level even here. Their faces, he says, shall never be ashamed. Now, it's not that David happened to be in this congregation of believers where everyone had film star looks. But I think the point is that there is a brightness even about the faces of God's people, or there should be. There should be a brightness about the faces of God's people because, for one thing, they're in love. Those who look to him are radiant, David says. That is, those who look to God. It's this radiance, this brightness about the faces of God's people is because they're in love with this God on whom they gaze. And secondly, because their consciences have been cleansed, their faces shall never be ashamed. There's no shame in their lives. Nothing clouds the face more, does it, than shame, a sense of guilt. and these people, God's people, their guilt has been dealt with, it's gone. And so there's no shame written across their faces. And so their faces are bright. We see it in an extreme case with Stephen, don't we, in the New Testament. As his enemies looked upon him, they saw his face was like the face of an angel. There was this literal radiance about the man's face. And we can say, oh, well, that was just a very unique and a miraculous situation. But I think David's saying here that his experiences as a brightness about the very faces of God's people, because they're in love with someone, with God, and because they have no shame, no guilt. And so David revels in being around God's people. He enjoys them. So he loves being an encouragement to God's people, being a worshipper with God's people, being an enjoyer of God's people. But then fourthly, he loves being an insider among God's people. Being an insider among God's people, verse 6. He says there, this poor man cried and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. Who's he talking about there? Well, you might read and think he's talking about himself, but I don't think that's necessarily the case. One of the commentators writes, the psalmist may actually point to someone in the audience as he says, this poor man. It would fit with this kind of communal theme of the first 7 verses. And so, in other words, what David has testified about himself in verse 4, I sought the Lord and he answered me and delivered me from all my fears. He's saying in verse 6, look, there are others around me who've had the same experience. This is a common experience. What's happened to me has happened to him and to her and to him. It's something we share. Now, see, if David had said in some other community, in some other context, amongst other people, I sought the Lord and he answered me and delivered me from all my fears, they'd look at him blankly and say, what on earth are you on about? They just wouldn't understand. But David is saying, here, among these people, they understand. It's happened to them as well. They know exactly what I'm talking about. It resonates with them deeply because they have experienced it too. In other contexts, I would feel like an outsider. Here, among God's people, I feel like an insider. A common experience of God's grace, and he revels in that as well. And so this is then the first reason David would tell us this evening. It's so great being a believer. Community. We're part of this community of God's people. We're not lone believers battling it by ourselves. We're part of a community where we can love being an encouragement to God's people. Where we can love being a worshipper with God's people. Where we can love being an enjoyer of God's people. And where we can love being an insider among God's people. What a wonderful thing it is, isn't it? Community. Secondly, fulfillment. Fulfillment, verses 8 to 14. And I think that then is, although not a word that the psalm uses, is the best word for what is described at a couple of points in this section of the psalm. First of all, in verses 9 and 10, where you have the language then of lacking nothing. Oh, fear the Lord, you his saints, for those who fear him have no lack. And again, verse 10, the young lions suffer want and hunger, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. The believer isn't then in this restless pursuit for more, but he lacks nothing. He has all that he could possibly want. And then verse 12, I think you have the same theme of fulfillment coming over again. Here in the language of kind of loving life, what man is there who desires life and loves many days that he may see good? And again, then it's a picture of a fulfilled existence, enjoying life, loving life, not finding life a terrible drag. Not finding it a dissatisfying experience, but loving life. And so those then are, I think, two descriptions of what I'm calling fulfillment. And David is saying then in these verses that the believer there. Not only is he part of a community, but secondly, he has a fulfilled existence. A fulfilled existence. And how then does he have that? How does the believer have this fulfilled existence? Well, David identifies two components. First of all, a relationship. He's fulfilled because of a relationship. So he uses the language in verse 8 of taking refuge in God. The believer takes refuge in God. And that's serious imagery. You think of a child. And those of you who are parents have perhaps had this experience. Your child is little and it's scared of something. Perhaps it's dogs. And they see a dog. And what do? They just run in that moment. They turn, they just run to you and grab hold of your legs, wanting to be picked up by you. That they're taking refuge in you. It's not just kind of dawdling along toward you and kind of just raising up their hand to be held, but it's this passionate, intense, earnest running to you to be picked up by you. And that's what David is talking about here as believers. We take refuge in God. It's an earnest relationship. Or again, in verse 10, he uses the language of seeking God. And again, we're talking about passionate, earnest, intense stuff. And that's one reason then, that's one ingredient in this fulfillment that the believer experiences, this fulfilled existence. It's because of a passionate, intense, deep relationship with God. But then secondly, it's because of a lifestyle. That comes across in verses 13 and 14, doesn't it? So in verse 12 he said, "What man is there who desires life and loves many days that he may see good?" And he's saying then in verse 13 and 14, this is the man who experiences that kind of fulfillment. The man who keeps his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit, turns away from evil, does good, seeks peace and pursue it. And we haven't got time to really unpack these details of which this lifestyle consists, but it's very much along the same lines as Ephesians 4 and 5, isn't it? Much of the ethics we've been studying on a Sunday morning. And David is saying then that these are the two ingredients in the believer's fulfilled existence. The believer has this relationship with God that's deep and intense, and this lifestyle that's holy and pure and consistent. And perhaps before we move on, it would be worth just returning to what I said in my introduction. Perhaps this evening, you're a believer who has lost the joy. You're a believer who would find it difficult to answer that question this evening. What's so great about being a believer? It's a slog for you. It's a grind for you. And perhaps then you're responding rather cynically to this, my second point this evening. And you're saying, well, it's all right. You're saying one of the great things about being a believer is fulfillment, having this fulfilled existence. That doesn't resonate with me this evening. I can't identify with that. That's not where I'm at. My existence doesn't feel particularly fulfilled this evening. Well, that's why I think it's important to note the exhortation with which this middle section of the psalm begins in verse 8. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. That's strong language, taste. Taste and see. You see, you can be standing right next to a table on which is loaded the most ravishingly delicious meal, the most ravishingly delicious food, all sorts of delicacies piled onto that table. But of course, you're not going to benefit from it one little bit by just standing there next to the table. Only if you taste it, only if you get stuck in. And David is saying, look, it's as you get stuck in to this relationship with God, and as you get stuck into this lifestyle, it's as you taste it, as you immerse yourself in the relationship and in the lifestyle, that the fulfillment starts to kick in. Don't just be a believer who stands next to the possibility of it, but gets stuck in. Taste and see. So what's so great about being a believer community, being part of this community of believers? Fulfillment. Knowing through this relationship and through this lifestyle, such a level of fulfillment, lacking no good thing. But then thirdly, deliverance. Deliverance. And this is verses 15 to 22, because that is clearly, you can see it straight away by just glancing very quickly over the verses. That's clearly a major theme. The word delivers there crops up at least a couple of times. Deliverance is clearly a theme of this final section of the psalm. And I think we can distinguish actually in these verses two distinct types of deliverance. So first of all then, deliverance from troubles. Deliverance from troubles, and this is verses 15 to 20. So by that I mean deliverance from temporal adversities, problems, trials, difficulties in this life. Deliverance from those. Now, I think it's important that we're careful in the way that we proceed here, because the deliverance that we experience then from troubles, from temporal adversities, it's a qualified deliverance. So, for one thing, it's not immunity or exemption. That's not what David's talking about here. He makes it quite clear that the Lord's people can be brokenhearted, verse 18. That they can be crushed in spirit. That they can, in fact, that they do experience many afflictions, verse 19. David is not for one minute saying, if you're a believer, then you never encounter troubles. That you're just immune from any contact with them. He's certainly not saying that. That's not the kind of deliverance we're talking about. It's not immunity. Second thing to say here, it ultimately looks forward to the future. This deliverance from troubles, it ultimately looks forward to the future rather than being a present reality. Why do I say that? Well, notice that in verses 15 to 17, we have a kind of sandwich, don't we? Verses 15 and 17 are very similar, talking about the Lord helping the righteous. Verse 16 in between is about what the Lord does to evildoers. In other words, in these three verses, we have a contrast, don't we, between two things. On the one hand, the Lord delivers the righteous from their troubles. On the other hand, the Lord cuts off the memory of evildoers. So to the righteous, he delivers them from troubles. With regard to evildoers, he cuts off their memory from the earth. That's the contrast we have in those verses. Now, here's the question. When does he do the latter? When does he cut off the memory of evildoers from the earth? Well, clearly he does that after they have died. It's irrelevant to talk about cutting off the memory of somebody unless they have died. So what he does to evildoers in verse 16 is a posthumous thing. It's beyond death. And presumably by the same logic then, if he cuts off the memory of evildoers after they've died, then similarly he delivers the righteous from their troubles after they've died. That's the contrast, and presumably the same timetable applies to both. It's beyond death, really, supremely, that he delivers the righteous from their troubles. And of course, the New Testament will fill this out wonderfully, won't it? And will make it clear, indeed, that this future deliverance from our troubles is not merely an escape from them. It's better than that. It's the abundant compensation for them. Our future glory, Paul says, will far outweigh all the troubles. It's not just that we'll finally be pulled out of the troubles, but we'll receive something else that is infinitely more substantial than the troubles were. The troubles will seem flimsy one day. By comparison, they don't seem flimsy tonight, I know. But one day, by comparison, they will seem flimsy. By comparison with what we've received in terms of glory then. that resurrection existence in a new world which is entirely and everlastingly free from any troubles. So it's a qualified deliverance because it's not immunity we're talking about. Primarily it looks forward to the future. And then thirdly, in this connection, in the meantime then, the deliverance consists in the attentive presence of God within our troubles. The eyes of the Lord being toward us and his ears being open to our cries for help. He's all eyes and all ears toward us within our troubles, David is saying. Or in the language of verse 18, he's near. Such a simple preposition, isn't it? Near. And yet so profound. It's what we want, isn't it, more than anything? What does brokenheartedness make us feel more than anything? It makes us feel cut off, isolated, alone. And David is saying that for the believer, within that brokenheartedness, God is near. And that's a form of deliverance in itself. It doesn't change the circumstance. But you have the most wonderful being in the cosmos right beside you. In the heat of the battle, in the heat of the furnace. So this deliverance from troubles then, it's real, but we need to qualify it in those three ways, not exemption. Ultimately, it looks forward to the future. In the meantime, it's God's presence with us in the troubles. But then, as I say, there's another type of deliverance that David talks about in these verses. Not only deliverance from troubles, but deliverance from condemnation. And this is verses 21 and 22. Twice there he uses that word, condemned. And as you'll know then, the word condemn, it's unambiguously legal language. It's a judicial term. It refers to being declared guilty by a judge in a court of law. That's what it means to be condemned. Being declared guilty by a judge. Now, theologians and Bible commentators will sometimes talk about a thing called a divine passive. A divine passive. What that means is a verb that's in the passive voice, but there's no... The agent of that verb, the person doing the thing, isn't identified. And in these divine passives then... it's that these theologians and these commentators are saying that the God is intended. Often then when we have a passive in the Bible with no agent identified, God is the intended agent. And that then is one way that actually you can see God in the book of Esther, for instance, where God is famously never mentioned by person. But there are a number of times in significant places these divine passives. So something being done for Esther, for Mordecai, for Israel. And the agent isn't identified, but we're probably supposed to read God there. And I think that we have a divine passive then here in verses 21 and 22. Who is the judge then? Who is condemning in verse 21 and not condemning in verse 22? Well, it's God. God is the intended agent here. And David then here is talking about deliverance then from condemnation by God as we stand, as all must stand, before the bar of his justice. We live in a moral universe where there must, for every creature, for every human being, be an examination, an assize. A judgment. And David is saying that believers enjoy deliverance from condemnation in that judicial appearance in God's courts. And here then, it's not qualified. Here it's absolute. Here we are talking about immunity. We're not talking about some kind of presence of God within being condemned. We're talking about simply no condemnation. This is immunity, this is exemption, this is a total deliverance we're talking about here. Deliverance from being condemned. And this then is the third reason this evening why it's great being a believer. We're part of this community. We have a fulfilled existence. And we are delivered, men and women. Delivered from troubles in the senses that I've described this evening. And delivered absolutely and without any qualification from condemnation. Isn't that wonderful tonight? And doesn't that actually then cast its light upon the troubles itself? That we are delivered from condemnation. What troubles can there really be if we are delivered from condemnation? The one great trouble that all of us faces is the trouble, the terrible prospect of standing before God, exposed in all our sin and our guilt and our moral filth. That's the one problem all of us have, really. And David is saying for the believer, that's gone, that problem. That problem no longer exists. There's no condemnation. You've been delivered from that. And all our other troubles are very much put into perspective by the fact we've been delivered from that great trouble. Great to be a believer and be delivered. So community, fulfillment, deliverance. But then fourthly and finally this evening, substitution. Substitution. Because in and of itself, then, verse 22 might seem a little unsatisfactory. Yes, it's great news that for those who take refuge in God, there's no condemnation. That's wonderful news, as we've been saying. But there doesn't seem to be an adequate basis for it. It seems to involve a certain level of injustice, surely, a certain miscarriage of justice. Because surely it should say none of those who are innocent will be condemned. Surely, in a context of justice being done, it's only innocent people who should avoid condemnation. And yet David is saying none of those who take refuge in him will be condemned. Well, that's great, but isn't it a little bit dubious? Isn't there a touch of impropriety about this judge not condemning those who simply take refuge in someone, rather than not condemning those who are actually innocent? Well, that's why verse 20, I think, is a crucially important verse here in our psalm. Now, on the face of things, and to us as we read the psalm, verse 20 just seems like another rather vivid detail in David's description of being delivered from our troubles, that God's pledges that our bones won't be broken. On the face of things, it just seems another detail in this description of deliverance from temporal troubles. But to David's first readers, to David's first audiences, it would have had a much deeper significance than that. They would immediately have recognized an allusion here to an earlier scripture, an allusion to Passover narratives, particularly Exodus 12. You know what I mean by the Passover. You know the great concept of all those lambs then being slain by Israelites on the night that they were freed from Egypt. And the whole significance of the lambs being slain was that they were substitutes, weren't they? They were bearing God's wrath in the place of the Israelites. God's wrath that fell on the Egyptians that night should have fallen upon the Israelites as well. The Israelites weren't really any better than the Egyptians were. They were idolaters as well. You can read Ezekiel 20 and it tells you that quite clearly. They deserved God's wrath as much as the Egyptians did that night. But the reason that they didn't receive God's wrath was because God had provided a substitute. The lambs then were substitutionary lambs. And it's stipulated then, there in Exodus 12, that the bones of the lambs weren't to be broken. The bones of the Passover lambs weren't to be broken. And any Israelite, as I say, hearing this, would immediately have thought of that. And yet, you see, the momentous thing here in Psalm 34:20, of course, is that we're not talking about an animal. We're talking about a person. And I think then that what we have here is a momentous passage, like others of a similar nature. Isaiah 53, an obvious one, where the authors are teaching Israel that actually the real Passover lamb, the real substitute who takes God's wrath in the place of God's people, isn't a white, fluffy beast. The real Passover lamb, the real substitute, is a person. And suddenly then, here in Psalm 34:20, we're looking at him. Suddenly in verse 20, we're not looking anymore at David or at the righteous generally, at believers generally. It's been believers who have been in view in verses 15 to 19. It's their troubles that God is so attentive to and from which he delivers them and so on. But suddenly in verse 20, it's as if we're the gaze has been redirected, the focus has changed, and we're no longer looking at believers generally. We're looking at this person. This person who, in a deeper sense, is going to be brokenhearted and crushed in spirit. Who, in a deeper sense, is going to experience many afflictions. And is going to do so in the process of being the ultimate substitutionary sacrifice, bearing God's wrath in the place of God's people. Or to put it more simply still, suddenly we're looking at Jesus. Which is why, when you move forward many books and many hundreds of years, to John chapter 19 and verse 36. You have there John telling us that as the soldiers walked around Golgotha that Friday evening, they broke the legs of the victims to ensure a speedier death until they came to Jesus, and they didn't break his legs because he'd already died. That was the obvious reason. That was the reason in their minds. But the deeper reason, John tells us, was that the scripture might be fulfilled. Not one of his bones will be broken. The scripture of Exodus 12 and the scripture of Psalm 34:20. And I'm saying then that this is why then we can come to verse 22. And read that for those who take refuge in God, there's no condemnation, and it's not dubious. And there's not a hint of injustice involved in God delivering this verdict of no condemnation on people like you and me. There's no impropriety involved here. Because there is a substitute. There is one who has been condemned. As we sang this morning, in my place, condemned he stood. There is one who has endured all the wrath and the condemnation and the fury and the damnation that we deserved, so that God with absolute propriety can say to us, no condemnation. And is that not the most thrilling reason it's great to be a believer this evening? We have a substitute. If you remember nothing else from Psalm 34 than that, take that away this evening. Why is it great being a believer? You have a substitute. You have someone who has endured the wrath which even this day, Sunday the 16th of March, in your life, cries out for. It cries out for wrath, doesn't it? The way you've lived today, the way I've lived today, cries out for condemnation, for wrath. The way we've been in the past hour even, the way we've been since we've been here, our hearts haven't been as full of the love of God and the love of each other as they should have been. Every moment of our existence cries out for wrath, and we have a substitute who has taken it all, so that God has already announced and will announce on that great day in a more public manner, for this person, that person, that person, no condemnation. Be glad tonight, you're a believer. Amen. Well, let's close with hymn 509, "And Can It Be That I Should..."